Recording has started. You may begin.
Thank you very much. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone. Welcome to the Privacy and Proxy Services Accreditation Issues PDP Working Group on Tuesday, the 8th of September. On today's call, we have Stephanie Perrin, Todd Williams, Sarah Bocchi, Frank Mishlik, Steve Metallitz, Sarah Wild, Darcy Southwell, James Bladell, James Gannon, Susan Prosser, Alex Deacon, Luke Seifer, David Cake, Michaeli Nalon, Kieran Manchet-Turville, Chris Pelling, Val Sherman, Justin Macy, Kathy Kleiman. We have apologies today noted from Terry Stummer, Holly Raich, Graham Bunton, and Don Blumenthal. From staff, we have Mary Wong and myself, Gisela Gruber. And if I may remind everyone to please state their names before speaking for transcript purposes. And apologies, I left Phil Corwin off the attendance. If I have left anyone's name off the attendance, if you'd kindly speak up now. If not, over to you, Steve. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gisela. Welcome, everyone, and thanks for getting on the call. Again, I think most of the people are on the phone bridge here rather than the Adobe, so I will we'll make sure that we walk through what is being shared on the screen. We've got a good agenda today, and we'll start as usual with any updates to the to statements of interest that people want to mention. Are there any updates? Okay, if not, our first agenda item, as you saw over the last few days, there were some output from two of our sub-teams for discussion today. Thank you to the sub-teams for producing that. The first one was from sub-team one. We had a partial discussion of sub-team one output a couple of weeks ago, and one question was reserved because they were still working on it. I think that question having to do with escalation of relay requests, they're now ready to report on that. So I don't know if Alex, are you reporting or Lindsay on this question one, and I'd ask the staff to put that up on the screen, the question one report.
Yes, Steve, it's Alex. I'll be reporting.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and get started.
Great. So this is Alex for the transcript. Just to bring everyone up to speed, this is the report of subgroup 1.3.2, question 1, which had to do with a mandatory forwarding of further form of notice when a persistent delivery failure has been found. If you remember, this section basically discussed in the outlined issues which the working group did not come to agreement on, and so we asked the public for further input and comment in the hopes that we would that they would provide guidance one way or another. After going through the comments and analyzing them, the subgroup found that unfortunately the answer was no. There was no clear consensus on the issue. And so I think what I'll do is I will just kind of jump right to the recommendations, which is a section at the end, and we'll start there. So the subgroup recommends that the working group discuss this this issue one more time, discuss if the mandatory forwarding of a further form of notice should be mandatory or not and see if we can come to consensus. If not, what I did was I modified the language from the reports, which you'll see at the bottom of the document, specifically the third bullet that outlines or that discussed this issue, and you'll see that what I did was remove the bracketed text, the text that we couldn't come to agreement on, and also made this obligation, if you will, a should instead of a must. And so those were our preliminary recommendations to the working group. Clearly, additional discussion is required, especially from the full working group. But maybe what I'll do is I'll just leave it there and take questions, and we'll take it from there.
Okay, thanks, Alex. Before we do that, I have the sense that the Adobe chat room is not functioning correctly here because I'm not able to use the chat function. We only show three people in the room, three participants in the room, and we don't have the text up on the screen, which I'm sure the staff has been trying to do. Mary is, or Gisela, do you know what the status is on the chat room here? On the Adobe?
Steve, it's working for everybody but you. So I think you probably need to refresh it. This is Karen.
Okay. Then it's just me. Sorry. Okay. Then let's open the floor to questions. Questions or comments on Alex's report. I guess first of all, if there are any other members of the subteam that on the call, I'm not sure there are. I think there are. I guess Sarah and David, Val, if any of you have any comments to add, this would be a time to do it. But if not, I can't see who's got their hand up, so if you would just let me know if you want to be in the queue.
Steve, James Blado has his hand up.
Okay, James, go ahead.
Thank you, Steve, James, for the transcript, and thank you, Alex, and the sub-team for putting this together. Just a question regarding the first recommendation, and I am still kind of skimming your report. I apologize if it's mentioned further up in the document, but when it says all party electronic requests alleging abuse by a privacy proxy service customer, I mean, do we, in other areas, for example, in Annex E, we established that the complaint should contain certain elements or follow a certain format. And are we saying that in this particular case that it really is just anything? Or do those elements and requirements also flow through to these requests as well? Or if something is missing, then it's not considered a valid allegation of abuse?
Sorry, this is Alex. I think it's important to note, James, that that first bullet there was a recommendation that I think there was agreement on. So this isn't new from the subgroup. This is text copied from our report. The only change to that section on this topic was the third bullet based on the input.
Okay, thank you. I guess that establishes that I didn't recognize something that's been in there for a while. So apologies for that. But I do. But I am asking the question, I guess, is when it says all third-party requests, are we saying that, you know, somebody sending something on the back of a napkin saying, I don't like this website, shut it down or something? I mean, really, there's no bar that has to, or no threshold that has to be crossed. We're saying all requests.
Well, James, this is Steve. It does say electronic request, so unless they scan the napkin.
Correct. Electronic. Yeah, I gotcha. But really, it can contain anything or nothing.
It has to allege abuse. I see Kathy's hand and then Mary.
Glad you can see me now, Steve. Thanks.
Yes.
Great. Hey, question, Alex, and thanks to the whole team for this comprehensive report. Okay, so one of the commenters, and I don't know who, said something about the abuse allegation itself being abuse. So, and I thought that was really, really interesting. So what happens here if the electronic requests themselves appear to be spam? So that it's, you know, if it's not coming in, say, to one of the domain name registrants, but to 100 or to 1,000 or to 10,000 that the proxy privacy provider might have. Harkening back to what James said, you know, should it be all or should it be all reasonably? You know, how do we deal with that comment about that the abuse request itself, the electronic request, might be spam or something else? Thanks.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah,
Mary,
this is Alex. Mary is next. Go ahead.
Hi, Steve. Hi, everybody. Thank you. And actually, Alex provided the specific answer, and I just wanted to provide a bit of context. In the report, this particular language comes after, you know, the other consensus recommendation about what it is that the provider has to forward. And this one is about escalation when there is a persistent delivery failure. So, as Alex said, this is the language in the report. Having said that, I think the other point that the working group, I think, noted when we were talking about all the different recommendations was that obviously there are places where we talk about illegal activity, there are places where we talk about abuse or abusive activity, and other places where we talk about malicious conduct. So we don't actually define abuse. So maybe James's question is something that folks might want to think a little bit about. But Alex is right, that comes from the report. And so maybe looking at the context of the report can help folks think through whether you want any more refinement to this particular sentence. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Mary. I'll just add on to that if you look at the our recommendation 16, it has two options for what type of electronic communications besides those required by the RAA and ICANN consensus policies must be forwarded. One is any electronic requests received containing allegations of domain name abuse. So that would kind of conform with what we have, what was in the issues we put out for public comment. The other is option one about all electronic requests received, but the provider may implement commercially reasonable safeguards to filter out spam and other forms of abusive communication. So that really, I think, covers the situation. One way we might deal with this issue is to, instead of saying all electronic requests, we'd say subject to the, you know, to point 16, or as defined in point 16, all electronic requests qualifying under point 16 will be forwarded. Because we provide two ways. I think we certainly recognize that there could be abusive communications appearing to be complaints about abusive activities, and I think we tried to give two different options for dealing with that. McKaylee, go ahead. You've been very
thanks, Steve. McKaylee for the record. No, I think we're just kind of working on the language that I think is important, because as others have pointed out, I mean, you do get some people who seem to have a huge amount of spare time on their hands and are quite happy to use that time just to harass people, or who just simply refuse to listen to reason. Speaking as a service provider, we have had to deep six reports from some companies for the simple reason that they just wouldn't actually acknowledge, you know, things that we were saying to them about what was the correct place to send them to and what we needed, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, leaving some flexibility here so that you don't end up in a situation where somebody abuses the abuse is important. And I appreciate that, you know, you obviously want a situation where the registrar and the service providers are still accountable, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, I don't think anybody wants a situation where you've enabled
enabled abuse via the abuse reporting tool, because that obviously is counterintuitive. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Michele. Okay, so we've had some discussion, I think helpful discussion, about actually a point that was not one that the subgroup was asked to look at, or a drafting question. If we can get back to the issue that this part of the this subgroup was asked to look at, which is whether there should be a mandatory process when there is a persistent delivery failure of a notice that is appropriate to be forwarded. Must the provider, upon request, forward a further form of notice, and if so, who should pay for that? So, as Alex's report indicated, there wasn't really a consensus among the comments received on these topics. So the numbers, at least, didn't provide us with any give us a lot of help. I guess I would ask, again, members of the subteam, if there are particular comments that were received. Kathy already mentioned one, which I think we've dealt with. But if there were other comments received that would shed light one way or the other on this question, or if there's, in other words, any new information to be brought to bear on this question that we discussed at some length several months ago about alternative forms of forwarding. If any sub-team members have any that they would like to point to, this would be a great time to do so. I see now that most people are in the Adobe room, but if you're not and wish to speak, just speak up. Okay, hearing no further comments on this, again, the subgroup recommended that the working group discuss this further, and I'm not hearing any further discussion on it. So I don't know, did the document just disappear from the screen for other people too?
I thought it was me. I was too quick on the trigger. This is Mary. I was putting up the other part of sub-team ones. Yeah, I'll put it back.
Go back. Thank you. Great, thank you. So now, if you scroll down to the third page here, and you look at the third bullet, this is the they're saying if there isn't any progress made through further discussion, then this sub team suggested we look at this language, chooses should rather than must, makes it so it's not mandatory to further form of notice, and it also. Lines out everything about the fee, because if it's not mandatory, I guess the reasoning was then there's you don't need to deal with who pays for the mandatory change. They added a few words at the end of the last sentence about a reasonable limit on the number of requests made by the same requester for the same domain name. So I guess to distinguish the circumstance in which there is one requester, but they're concerned about multiple domain names. So let me just ask if there are any comments on this or any concerns about making the changes that are put forward here as part of the sub-team recommendation. I see James Gannon. If anybody else wants to get in the queue, please speak up if you're on the phone or put your hand up in Adobe. James, go ahead.
Hi, James. So I just have a quick question, I suppose, for Alex. Sorry for the background noise. Was there any discussion in the sub-team around differentiating between the same domain name and the same registrant? Because you could have a registrant with multiple domain names and end up in the same situation where it may become a very repetitive exercise. So should the limitation actually be on multiple requests on the same registrant rather than the same domain name? Was there any discussion around that?
James, just for clarification, by definition, we don't know who the registrant is at this point, does the requester, do we?
Yes, but the provider will.
So you're saying that the provider would disclose that these are all...
yeah, I suppose that's a good point. Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah, okay, forget the question.
Okay. Any other comments on this? Okay. If no further comments, then I think we're moving along the path of making these changes. Obviously, if people think about this and have other points to add in the next couple of days on the list, that would be great. But if not, I think we want to thank this sub-team for helping us move this forward and close out at least some language here. We also have had a good discussion about the first bullet there and making sure that that's conformed with the other recommendations as far as what communications need to be forwarded. So that would conclude that part of the sub-team one report. Now, the next document that's up there now, which is a revised version of the summary and analysis from on question two. We had a discussion about question two a couple of weeks ago. Let me just ask if someone on the sub-team wants to present this document or walk us through this and tell us what changes have been made to this document.
Steve, this is Val Sherman speaking. I'd be happy to do that.
Okay, Val, go ahead.
Okay, great. So, well, we had a pretty good discussion, and as you know, question two is composed of four sub-questions on quite a few comments really supported the idea that there's great support for contractual deference to the contracts between providers and their customers. So question one, should it be mandatory for accredited providers to comply with express requests from LEA not to notify the customer? Pursuant to the working group discussion, we should clarify, we recommend that we clarify in the final report that express LEA requests not to notify are to be complied with where it is required by applicable law. And also clarify that any and all working group recommendations on this topic are not intended to prevent providers from adopting any more stringent standards in their terms of service or to simply cooperating voluntarily with LEA where they see so fit. So that is the fine, that appears to be the outcome of that particular sub-question. Question two, should it be mandatory publication for certain types of activities, for example, malware, viruses, or other types of violations of terms of service relating to illegal activities? You know, again, a lot of the comments demonstrated a deference to contractual agreements. And in so doing, the responses really supported the preliminary recommendations 6 through 8 of our initial report on provider terms of service. It was also noted in the working group that providers generally and already have the discretion to terminate service for breach of their terms, which frequently would hypothetically result in publication. And again, the working group noted that there should be no restriction on providers being able to so do, subject to, however, any other specific limitations or recommendations by the working group. For example, we may consider whether certain types of behavior could require that there be some sort of other action, like a suspension of the domain name pending an investigation or something of that sort. It was also noted that it's probably not possible to create a general policy that would in all cases prevent publication where the customer is ultimately shown to have not been in breach. But as we finalize our recommendations for the final report, the working group may wish to consider that a provider be required to first notify the customer if the alleged ground for termination is malware, for example. So with regard to question three, remedies for unwarranted publication, again, the responses supported the preliminary recommendations 6 through 8, terms of service deemed to be sufficient to provide any remedies for unwarranted publication. It may be useful to clarify the language in the final report to refer expressly to the possibility that in many cases the provider's terms of service and the applicable law will provide for the remedy, or should be deferred to for the remedy. Now, sub-question four, should a similar framework and other considerations apply to requests made by third parties other than LEA or intellectual property owners? We decided, based on our discussion a couple of weeks ago, that we will kind of loop back around to this question or reconsider it in light of recommendations from sub-team three, which is evaluating Annex E. We also wanted to note that there was a comment provided by Black Knight Internet Solutions that suggested that the working group look to establish policies around disclosures already in place by some country code managers. For example, SIRA, which runs the Canadian CA country code. So this suggestion may be of interest to some of the questions, but again, maybe appropriately first analyzed by sub-team three. One example, for the Canadian, for the country code disclosure procedures, there's actually several that provide for specific forms to be filled out, like CA, for example, requires that there be a current good faith dispute with the registrant, requires the provision of certain information, requires that certain criteria be complied with that essentially safeguards privacy while also balancing the interests of the whatever other interests may be at hand of whether it's IP or others. We do want to note that quite a few months ago, the ICANN staff has prepared a summary of selected CCTLD practices, and those are also posted on our wiki page. And I believe, Mary, correct me if I'm wrong, have been sent around more recently.
Val, I don't recall when it was sent around, but you're right, that's posted on the sub-team wiki page. And, of course, depending on what the working group wish to do with this particular point, I'm happy to send it around or send it around to the point people. Thanks.
Thank you. So that really is where we are with question two.
Okay, thanks very much, Val. I appreciate your walking us through those recommendations, and I also appreciate the sub-team giving us some concrete, fairly specific recommendations here. So you suggest some clarifications on question one. I guess perhaps the same in question two. I just want to come back to that. And then on question three, again, just referring to the provider's terms of service and applicable law. I think that just kind of runs throughout here. Question four, you point out that this may overlap considerably with what's happening in sub-team three. So we'll be hearing from sub-team three a little bit later in this meeting. Let me just open the floor to any questions or comments on these recommendations from the sub-team that Val has just walked through. I see Kathy has her hand up. Anybody else, please get in the queue. Kathy, go ahead.
Hi. Question for Val and for anyone else on the sub-team. Regarding question two, the mandatory publication, I agree that I agree with one of the findings and have a question about the other. The finding that it should, that we should follow the terms of service, that providers should follow their terms of service makes sense. But the requirement to notify a customer before publication of their data in the WHOIS, before it's globally available, seems to me to be one that was amplified by the comments. There were a number of comments that talked about once it's done, it cannot be undone. This type of publication then becomes part of the public record. And that you can't put a rabbit back into a hat. And the dangers, we heard a lot about the dangers, a lot about the dangers of the type of information that might be published. So the idea of notifying a customer for all publications seems to be something that logically arises out of a number of the comments we received, kind of in the thousands. I'd be interested in your responses on that. Thanks. And whether we can move towards that finding.
Okay, thanks, Kathy. Val, do you want to respond?
Sure. Well, Kathy, without having the benefit of the thoughts of others in the group at this moment, I don't really see any issue with that. I think it's certainly something that we, as a working group, may consider. I personally don't see a problem. So unless somebody else can offer a reason why that might be a sticking point, I think that would be that is something that at least several of the comments have mentioned. Like you said, if it's something that provides, you know, really our goal is to resolve issues, not to kind of to create additional problems or to violate any rights without any kind of justification. So I don't have a problem with making that a recommendation.
Great. Thanks, Val.
Thanks, Val. I see Vicki and McKaylee. So, Vicki, go ahead.
The only caution that I would raise, and forgive me because I'm not sure it fits in here or not, the only caution I would raise is with respect to law enforcement, and I don't know if that applies here or not, but I heard Kathy say always. And so I just would want for us to reserve, assuming we're going to hear from law enforcement at some point, if we haven't already, on how what they think about that issue.
Okay, thank you, Vicki. McKaylee, go ahead.
Thanks, McKaylee, for the record. Two things. One, on the law enforcement matter, I think that's covered by the jurisdictional issues. I mean, ultimately, if an American law enforcement agency wants us as an Irish company to do something, they better make sure that they're asking it via their Irish counterpart, because otherwise we're just going to ignore it. And that's the reality. To Kathy's point, there's an issue here in that it's what, you know, if you want me to inform a client that I'm going to do something, what's the consequence of that? I mean, what are you expecting to happen once I've informed them? That's my question. I mean, if you have breached our terms of service for any number of different reasons, we are going to terminate the service we provide to you in terms of who is privacy or any other number of services that we may or may not provide to you. If I inform you I'm terminating the service, what do you expect? That you're going to be able to stop me from terminating the service, or is it that you simply just want to be told that I'm terminating the service? Because I'm trying to understand what that notification, what's the purpose of the notification? Because I can assure you, as a service provider, there's no way we're going to continue to provide you with the service if you're in breach.
Sure.
Do you understand what I'm kind of getting at?
Happy to respond. It's a good question.
Go ahead.
Steve, okay?
Okay.
So, McKaylee, you may have just solved the problem. If you're notifying a customer that you are terminating the proxy privacy service, you've solved the problem right there. You've notified them. What I would want to do is, you know, there may be other issues. There may be infringement allegations. There may be a joint venture I had with my ex, and we're fighting over who owns the intellectual property. It happens every day in divorce court. But what I would want is notification that I need to put armed guards in front of my house because my personal address that I've kept from my ex is about to go up on the web. So it's really more any form of notice that allows the customer to know that their address is about to be published, or their company's address or their organization's address is about to be published, at least gives them a heads up of whatever they may need to do. And given some of the cases we've talked about, there may be people who will need to go underground.
Kathy, just coming back on you very, very briefly, you see, you've now opened up another can of worms, because if you want to put armed guards in front of your house, since we want to use that example, how much time are you going to want between us informing you that we're removing the service and us removing the service? And it's Michele for the record, Gisela, sorry. This is where the problem for me would arise, is that if, for example, and it happened to us a couple of years ago, somebody was using a domain name for a particular purpose, and we ended up with being potentially dragged into a couple of €100,000 worth of, court case over something we knew nothing about, I don't want to be dallying around waiting a day or 2 days or 3 days whilst giving you time to go off and get your armed guards or whatever. I mean, not that I want you not having your armed guards, Kathy, but, the thing is, are you expecting a certain amount of time between the notification and the action, I suppose, is what I'm asking. Thanks.
That's a really good question. Can I throw out there whether there is time now, and also say this is something that would require some research? This isn't something I should probably answer off the top of my head. It's a really good question. But I think some time is definitely in order, especially given what we've now heard from 21,000-plus commenters of the importance of proxy privacy registrations to them.
I'm sorry. Were you done, Kathy?
I'd love to, one, know what other, how it's done now, and then also kind of think about it and research it. My gut sense is at least 24 hours notification, but there may be precedent that we have in unlisted phone numbers and other things that before something becomes listed, that there's a certain amount of time that we wait in certain countries. So I would want some time to take a look at that so I can present it to working group. Thanks.
Okay, so let's specify what we're talking about here, and I see Mary had her hand up, and I want to also get to James. We're talking about, regardless of what's in the terms of service, should there be some requirement to notify a customer of a service before he or she has that service terminate, for whatever reason, I guess we're talking about here. Mary, I think you had your hand up, and then we'll go to James.
Thank you, Steve, and thank you, James, for the deference in AC chat and reality. So this is not a specific answer to Kathy's question because I don't have one, but if it will be helpful to this discussion, way back, I think it might have been September, the staff did a sample and a survey of privacy and proxy providers, and we did get back some responses, which I believe we circulated to the working group. And what I recall from that exercise is that there is a variety of practices. Thanks, James. Yes, September. Well, last September, yes. And so a year ago, that there was a variety of practices across the providers. For example, some would include a clause on what notice they give, and some of these basically said, well, some grounds of notification will give you notice. Others either did not have a clause on notice at all or said, we may give you notice, et cetera, et cetera. In addition, I think some providers said that they do tell their customers what the consequences of publication are and some don't. So I guess the sense that we took away from that discussion last September was that, there's already provider practices out there, so it's a question of how much the working group wants to make something mandatory or common. Thanks.
Thanks, Mary. James Bledel.
Thank you. James speaking for the transcript, and I think going back to our practices, we do, in fact, provide notice that, that a customer has violated our terms of service and that we were terminating that service in accordance with our customer agreement. I bet provide sufficient window for some of the things that Kathy was discussing or raising, and I don't know that that's basically instantaneous or how quickly you can check your email. I just want to maybe put out there the idea that as a service provider, we're much more likely to, let's say, you know, these services are, once again, set up to protect private information from falling into third parties who would use them for abuse, spam, marketing, and spurious claims of infringement. They're not designed to provide a safe harbor from which to conduct illegal activity. And I know that, you know, there's some distrust or suspicion of LEA on some levels, but for the most part, if an applicable law enforcement agency is making a request, I mean, I think that most providers are simply going to comply and not necessarily, insert themselves between their customer and law enforcement. I'm just raising that, as a matter of general principle. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, James. James Gannon, go ahead.
Hi, James Gannon. I think if we're going down this route, there's some complexity involved. So I think what others have said, particularly Kathy, I would be broadly in agreement with, and I think it would be a useful exercise to try and collate at least a representative selection of what's in current providers' terms of service to give the working group some reference to work off of. But I think there's an important distinction as well we have to make between voluntary and involuntary issues with domain names. So if we go down the route of, say, for example, having an example of a site that's hosting malware, there can be many instances where that registrant is a genuine privacy proxy user and is not intending to use the domain for illegal purposes, but through bad security or any number of other things will end up hosting malware unknowingly. So we need to make sure that if we do go down to the route of having a paragraph in the policy around notification and to allow the providers to have the flexibility to do, I personally prefer to see us having some type of sufficient window given to registrants to make sure that, you know, at-risk registrants are given sufficient time to put in place risk management measures for themselves. But we need to be able to differentiate between blatant and knowing abuse and possible voluntary abuse. And I understand that that does introduce complexity, but it's an important distinction that we'll have to make as we go along. Oh, and I want to know, thanks, Mary, in the chat, if that's what you were talking about, that'd be brilliant. I'll have a look at that.
Thanks, James. I'll take... I see David Cake's hand, only it just went down. I don't know if you wanted to speak, David, but if you do, put your hand back up. This has been a good discussion, and I would ask for people to think about this, and let's continue this discussion on the list. And again, just to be clear, what we're talking about here is should there be some requirement that service providers, regardless of what's in their terms of service, provide some advance notice, how much to be determined, before terminating service. This is publication. This is not disclosure on a one-off basis. This is publication to the world. And should they be required to do that? Should that be a minimum standard for accreditation? So I'll be particularly interested to hear from the providers about how that might affect them, as well as from all the other members of the working group. David, did you have something else on this topic, or another topic that's in the sub-team recommendations here?
I guess. Can you hear me?
Hey, Steve.
Can people hear me?
David?
Can people hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, David. Go ahead.
I can hear.
Oh, good. Okay. To take up James's point about there's voluntary and involuntary, we did get a couple of comments in the sub-team that suggested that actually dealing via the domain name system entirely was often inappropriate, particularly for malware, where it may be, as James said, involuntary. Someone's placed it on a website. And a lot of people said most of the time for these issues you should really be dealing with the hosting provider rather than the DNS at all. But there's a whole lot of uncertainties there about what kind of malware. We've got to talk about, you know, future kinds of malware we may not have even seen in the wild yet, and issues about whether it's even possible to contact the hosting provider without going via the DNS and so on. So there's a whole bunch of issues here that people talked about in this, where often, if it's involuntary, no useful purpose is served by reveal at all. It may be useful for be able to contact them, but that doesn't mean to make their information public. And
whoever's typing, please mute your microphone. Thank you. Go ahead, David.
And we may be getting into a sort of realm where, rather than some recommendations rather than some strict policy, we may be getting into sort of best current practice territory.
Okay, thank you.
What is an appropriate way to behave in response to certain kinds of complaints?
Let's move on from that topic then, and let's ask people to discuss on the list whether this should be an additional accreditation criterion, or is it better in the realm of best practice? And if so, if it is a criterion, how would that be? Let me ask if there are any other comments at this point on the other recommendations from this document from Subteam 1, particularly items 1 through 3, because on number 4 they're mostly referring over to Subteam 3. Any other comments on this at this point? If not, let's ask folks to review this over the week. I know people have had it only since Friday, and it was a holiday weekend for some people. So please take a look at this, and let's see if we can get this also closed off next week. I'll turn now to the next agenda item, which is partial report from Subteam 3. And we have two documents up there. One is a summary of their analysis, and the other is a revised illustrative draft disclosure framework, in other words, revisions to Annex E. This subteam had a tough assignment, and we appreciate the time and effort that folks have put into this. Let me ask if there's someone from the subteam who'd like to walk us through these documents, which may be all we have time for today, but if you could kind of let us know what we're looking at here. Is there someone from – I see Todd has his hand up. So, Todd, why don't you go ahead?
Thanks, Steve. Todd Williams for the transcript. Can everybody hear me okay?
Hear you fine.
Great. So that's right, two documents here, just a general overview of what they are. One, as you noted, is a revised summary of what we presented several weeks ago to the broader working group, adds a lot of context, a lot of direct quotations from some of the comments that we were analyzing to give a broader picture. The second, as you noted, is a revised disclosure framework that attempts to incorporate the comments that we reviewed, the substantive suggestions that the comments made, either additions or edits. And two broad points as the working group reviews these and perhaps over the next week, and then we can talk about them in more detail next week. One is that this revised disclosure framework does not represent something where the members of the subteam went over the substantive merits of the comments that we were reviewing and said, yes, this will work, no, that won't work, or did any kind of reached consensus or anything of that nature. Rather, this is just taking the summary that's in the first document and simply for kind of illustrative purposes, folding it into the language that already exists to say, okay, if the working group decided that this particular comment has substantive merit and that we wanted to make certain edits or additions, this is one particular formulation of how that might look. So I just wanted to make that clear from the outset. It's more of a tool to facilitate further discussion and not necessarily a finished consensus product or anything like that. The second broader point is that if you'll recall, when we presented our initial summary to the larger working group several weeks ago, there was a lot of discussion about what exactly verifiable evidence from the, say, domain privacy petition looked like and what exactly that term meant. And one idea that we as a subteam had was to kind of sidestep that debate, at least for now, as to whether what was already in the disclosure framework would have met verifiable evidence or not, and instead, you know, fold that term into the revisions that we are doing. And then as a whole, as a working group, once we've looked at the new revised language, then discuss whether that meets verifiable evidence. So in any event, that's what this document includes, you know, subject to, obviously, further debate among the larger working group. So those are kind of the two broad points as everybody reviews. Thanks.
Thank you, Todd. And so just, and that's very useful so it's these really aren't recommendations of this subteam. You're just trying to incorporate into Annex E the thrust of some of the comments, and then to
yes, exactly.
In other words, yeah. Go ahead.
No, that's exactly right, Steve. Just
okay.
As you were reviewing, I didn't want anybody to think that, like I said, we had debated the merits and come to some sort of final conclusion or recommendation. Frankly, you know, that is something that the larger working group can do as we look through this document. But this is just to kind of help facilitate that. For example, if you're looking at a particular comment, this is where the substantive merits of that comment might come into play, basically.
Okay. So, in effect, would it be fair to say that when we look at this revised Annex E, the second document here, this is the subteam's best effort to say this is what the document would look like if we took all the comments at face value and took them into account here.
Correct.
Again, this is an area where we reached a tentative conclusion. We had this Annex E, but we obviously sought public comment on it. And we're not, you know, counting heads here. We're trying to come up with the best outcome. But if we were to be guided by the specific comments, it would look kind of like this. So I think that's a fair way to characterize this document that's up on the screen now. Okay, so let me open the floor to comments either from other members of the subteam or from members of the working group. I see Kathy, who is another member of the subteam, I believe.
Yes.
Put your hand up. If anybody else please wants to speak, please get in the queue. Thanks.
Thanks, Steve. A quick note, without getting into the merits of anything, but that this revised Annex E is really based on, my understanding of the summary, it's based on the summary section 2, taking those comments that have support for the basic premise of Annex E. People, as you read through this, people should really look at section 3. Which is those who, I mean, there were thousands of comments of those who opposition for the basic premise of Annex E. We got over 11,000 comments that in some way or other fall into a category of opposing disclosure of publication, some under all circumstances, some want a court order. But I'd really look at sections 2 and 3, and this revised Annex E really is a reflection of the changes requested by those who responded in section 2, that they like Annex E, but they wanted to go much farther. Thanks, Steve.
Great. No, thank you. That's helpful. Other comments on this? Vicki, go ahead. If anybody else wants to be in the queue, please raise your hand.
Yeah, and there is some disagreement with what Kathy just said. I mean, clearly the EFF petition was no disclosure as in a court order. The other petition, some argue that it generally supported NXC, and there was a question of what verifiable evidence means. I think Kathy's description of it is debatable. Thanks.
Okay. So that's right. And I think Todd would agree that changes to NXE are assuming we will have an NXE, and if you look at the viewpoint of those who feel we should not have an NXE and not provide any requirements for how to handle these requests. So that's something we certainly have to take into consideration. I see that we're nearing the top of the hour now, and it probably is not that useful to dive into these sub-team three documents, which are pretty extensive and were circulated a few days ago. So let me ask that everybody take a look at these, and let's be prepared to get into more detail on them on our call next week, if possible. And just to review what else we have, we had a very good report from Sub-Team 1, very specific, and I think for the most part we've got some concrete recommendations, and I would like to hear on the list, particularly from anybody who has concerns about those. And one open question is this issue of whether there should be some mandatory advance notice before a privacy proxy service is terminated. And we've heard some viewpoints on that, but that's something I would ask people to think about, and again, whether that should be an accreditation requirement or possibly a best practice. On Sub-Team 2, I think we had a big discussion last week, and I said at the end of that we would try to get some language from the co-chairs out to the group, and that's still my hope to try to do that for next week. So please stay tuned. We've already talked about Sub-Team 3, which will be, a focus of our discussion next week. And then on Sub-Team 4, I think we're going to reach out to the co-conveners on that and see where things stand and what we can do to move that process forward. So that's my brief snapshot, anyway, of where we are. I think we're making we made some good progress today, and hopefully we'll continue to do that in the next several weeks, which will be quite critical. So thank you all for your participation, and unless there are any closing comments, I don't see anybody's hand up. So please be active and vocal on the list this week if you possibly can, and we will all talk again next Tuesday. Thank you.
Thank you.